People of the earth, those with ears here, welcome to the Most High Show, a mildly weird and mostly helpful podcast made by and for people in recovery. That's a new intro. Our guest today is my friend Reed Smith, who is the founder of Centered Recovery Programs. Their program's primary goal is mental and physical well-being for all of their clients. In a well-balanced mental and physical health, sobriety is a natural byproduct, and there is no longer an urge to find escape in a bottle. I like that summary. Sarah with the capital H is here.
Capital H.
And I'm your host, Christian, and this is Mindfulness, Fear, and the Human Condition on the Most High Show.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
So, I don't know who's heard of Richard Rohr.
Very familiar.
So, I call him my spiritual grandpa, Richard Rohr. And this is what he has to say about fear. We're going to start with fear. Is that cool? This is what he writes. What do we do when our fears are in fact rational? When fear and wisdom are enmeshed. When would it be foolish to not fear? More often than we realize, fear is a productive intuition. It is what stops you from driving with no headlights on, from touching your hand to the flame, from going outside to meet coyotes. I guess that's a thing. He's in New Mexico. We don't have to demonize our fear to survive it. For this reason, I have an aversion to the language of conquering our fears. We are not at war within ourselves. It is better to listen with compassion. Interesting. Reed, why don't you, what is that when I sent that out and then I read it now? What is that invoke in you? What thoughts or?
Sure. That might be just a opportunity for intelligence to operate.
Yeah.
You see a brink, you don't go over it. I don't think that, in my experience, that's where people are struggling, right?
Right.
Like if a bus is coming at you, there's moving out of the way, but there's really not. As those things unfold, I don't think it allows for thought to play a role to produce something conceptual. There's just acting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I had an experience this week where I was off in the morning, you know, like just on one, and, you know, or some might call it anxious. And I'm like, oh, this is fear, right? It was some fear around financial stuff. And then I sat with it and I was like, oh, this is fear, first off. So stop freaking out. And when I realized and called it what it was, fear, then I was able to put that rational mind in play and I was able to go, oh, I need to take some action here. So it was, I think there's some things that like, and what Richard Rohr is getting at here is like, when the fear is coming up, like there might be some action I need to take. But if I don't acknowledge what I'm feeling as, oh, it's fear, and I'm just kind of like reacting to the emotional state I'm in, then I won't even catch that. You know what I mean? I won't even know that here's an opportunity for me to take positive action towards a solution because I'm so caught up in fear, right? Like, I think that that's where you're talking about is how do we do that? Because I feel like it's taken me a long freaking time to just have that moment of going, oh, that's fear, right? Our friend, you were talking about, you know, Adam Abramowitz. And when I first started hanging out with Adam, he tripped me out because he would talk about, oh, I'm scared. And I'd be like, what? Oh, you're scared, dude. What? Like it was not, but what it ended up being was it ended up being empowering to me because I'm like, oh, like he's calling it what it is. He knows that this is just fear and he's scared. But for me, the first, my first instinct when he said he was scared was, oh, he's weak. Yeah. Yeah.
I like how you separated, like, your first thought from the reality was, you know, your first thought being like, oh, he's being weak. But the reality was actually he's identifying what it is. Because I think a lot of times, like, what makes our fears get larger than life is that we try to pretend that they're not there. And so then we're never addressing them. Because if you don't call it what it is, how can you possibly address it?
Yeah.
So making that distinction, I think that was really cool.
Yeah. All right. So how do we make that distinction? How do we know that's what's going on? And how often is it really going on?
Well, let's back up, because when it comes to the survival of us, right, which extends to our family, then shelter, which costs money.
Yeah.
Those things are, I used to get in my head that I was in my head around money.
Yeah.
And then realizing that's kind of like one of those, Maslow's triangles, basic things. And, you know, we're primitive man. When he didn't have shelter, he needed shelter. That was an actual problem. Same with food. So those are the ones that when they come up, like you're talking about, action. But I think a lot of the times energy is spent on attempting to do this piecemeal, like I have a fear of, and then that variable changes over time. So I think it's helpful to look at fear in a more general way to see what the nature of it, what actually is unfolding that allows for the experience of what thought has labeled as fear,
yeah,
to be present.
Yeah.
So when you say fear in a general way, do you mean like fear as fear itself, or when you have individual fears, kind of grouping them into similarities and seeing what, like, if it, you have this specific fear and this specific fear and this specific fear, but they all go back to like the fear of abandonment?
The only thing to fear
is fear itself.
That's right. That's right. I don't know. I think in the moment, if the moment demands action and intelligence operates, it's really different than a fear of tomorrow. I think that in order for fear to be present, it appears in time, inwardly. Right? Inwardly. And this is the result of thought. So fear, the substance, is thought. It's not out there, obviously. It's inside. So the root of fear is thought producing time.
Oh.
Inward time.
Yeah. That's that's where you're making the distinction between physical well-being. That's more of an instinctual kind of thing. We call it fear, but separating it from what you're saying, which is thought taking whatever it is and saying that's...
means that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Assigning meaning to it.
And then the body's, thought is a material process in the brain, and all that neurochemistry fires off inside the body. So the body... that energetic state has just been labeled XYZ, right? And to see that it's thought, for me, it means something different. The meaning changed.
Yeah.
Seeing that what's really gone is maybe you could accurately, inwardly state it as fearful thinking is present. Fearful thinking is present.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with, I think it's Alan Watts? because there's this artist, Enzo, who has sampled some of Alan Watts' speeches, and there's a song called Overthinker. And in this Alan Watts speech, it says, a person who thinks all the time has nothing to think about except thoughts. So he loses touch with reality and lives in a world of illusions. Hmm. So I like, because when you said that if the thought demands action, that got me thinking, because I was like, wow, that really puts a different perspective on the fear. Is this like a generalized fear, like the fear of tomorrow, the fear of what's coming? Mm-hmm. Or is this like, you know, am I about to cross paths with a bus? Do I need to get out of the way?
Right.
But yeah, because when you think and then you just keep thinking and then you keep thinking, it just snowballs. But all there is thoughts.
Right.
But isn't there something alluring in a diabolical way of just sitting in a bath full of your fearful thoughts? Like, don't we somehow become so attached to that or addicted to that, connected to that as our persona, that it's almost like becomes who we are, and then we choose that consistently over and over and over again? Or am I only crazy mode in here?
Because it's because you're an artist.
Yeah,
it fuels your art.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I need the depth of emotions to pull something out, right? Mm-hmm. But I mean, I know people like that who are, you know, just kind of fear-driven, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, successful people who it's all about fear and protection and defense and...
Security.
Security, but not like where you're talking about on like a physical, just purely like, do I have the hierarchy of needs? But it's like expanding that out so far, you know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right. So when it's materially the body, it makes sense to, security is a good thing, but you're right. It's just been extended into a psychological realm. The sense of me being secure tomorrow, being secure.
Yeah.
So,
and then that thought, I mean, like, it can almost become like a collective consciousness, right? Where enough people hanging out with that same kind of brainwave going becomes, you know what I mean? Like, it almost like can seep into a collective group of people that's how they're existing and thinking. And then everything gets kind of put in that, under that filter. So they're never really seeing things as they are, because they're always filtering it through this like fear lens, right? If you're thinking about, if we're kind of talking about it, thinking about thought.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to untangle my mind after this episode.
Yes. That's what happened last time. What do you do when someone's coming to you? Because you work with people on a daily basis, right? Uh-huh. And you've developed a center and modalities and methods to confronting a lot of human conditions. And when we first talked about what we're going to do on this episode, I'm like, you know, I think fear is just like a constant human thing. We all, you know, how do you, when someone's coming to you that with these kind of issues, what's kind of like your pathway for them to say, all right, what do you do with that?
Sure. Well, let's talk about what they ordinarily do. Right, because we can start with what we're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
All the things that sell books, self-improvement, self-confidence, all of these operate from a fundamental assumption that there is a self that can improve, that can get better esteem, that can be more confident. So it's important to look into what's going on that allows for the experience of feeling as if there is a me over here doing the thinking and the sensing and all this. And to begin with, it's not me, Reed, who thinks and feels, but these expressions in the body of how thought expresses itself is producing the sense of a me in time. So the thinking produces me. There's not me over here doing the thinking. It's mm-hmm. just a reflex involuntary in the brain. There's not a... So I think an insight into the nature of how thought operates if explored and an insight is had, eliminates a lot of the questions that are challenges that people are faced with. Like, why do I do this? How am I going to change? That question, how and why, employ thought to produce an answer. Mm-hmm. And thought is from memory. It's from the past, so it's limited. And your life, until maybe some insight is had into the nature of the mind, then thought will remain functioning and mean the same thing. So there's more general areas to look at that, when looked at, an insight influences the particular.
Yeah. So, I mean, would another way to say it, like a fifth grade level, like identity, kind of getting that identity, like if you're, because like if you're identifying yourself as this thing, then you're fighting this battle, this thing that doesn't necessarily exist, because it exists in your, the projection of your mind. Mm-hmm. Is this, I feel like we're in the cosmos already, but.
Do you feel like you're floating?
I do.
I feel like I'm floating.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So is it kind of like identity? Because I think, like, how does one, you know, like become non-entity, right? Like, how do you become?
Well, there is a body here, right? And there's the life force is expressing itself. There's an awareness of what's appearing and what I'm hearing and the temperature. So the awareness of my environment. And then at the same time, concurrently, same awareness, there's awareness of this physical form and all of its functionings. So this body is a sensory perception apparatus, which includes a brain. And
the body is a sensory production.
Sensory, it's a...
it's a giant antenna.
It is. Yeah. It is. And we... So just imagine all of us were babies, and when we were babies, there wasn't the sense of being read, and this physical form learned to walk, learned to communicate in a language. So it wasn't read who learned to walk, right? It wasn't read who learned English. And that little baby, at some point, naively, thinking begins unfolding. Mm-hmm. Without an awareness that thinking is unfolding. Awareness is aware of being that particular form.
Right. Yeah.
It's not when we become 18 to 24 months and we're considered to be self-aware. In fact, there's awareness of the self.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, as we learn cup, phone, bottle, all of these names to form, the forms are out there for the senses to bear on to determine whether things are working or not.
Yeah.
It's very helpful that the world, we can interact with it. But when this psychological information gets stored in the brain and begins to operate, then it's treated as if it exists like a cup and you can explore it, but in fact it's it rises through this movement of thought, and as it takes shape, that expression in the body is the feedback loop to the quality of how this thing is functioning.
Right. Yeah.
So what's felt in the body isn't a confirmation of what thought is saying in awareness, but more often than not, it's a rejection.
Anybody in
you with me?
Need it? Yes. I want to make sure that everyone's like following, because I think you're dropping some powerful shit.
The body, like if anyone in here were to touch my shoulder, I don't know who's touching it. You know, it's really generic. This thing is very, very generic in how it unfolds, mm-hmm. and it's only thought that is the thing changing.
Yeah.
But to see that I'm not the one doing it, and then it just goes on just like breathing. I still experience all those things that I did before, but they no longer mean the same thing. They don't carry the significance. It's just like, oh, yeah, there it is.
Yeah, so maybe it's another way to say it, maybe it's kind of like zooming out or creating separation and acknowledging that, like, I think what happened to me in that morning, right, of just rather than just reacting to this chemical system that was going on, which I do think that maybe there is some biological wiring that gives me a propensity to already be kind of, you know, in an anxious state, right? And so I have had to combat that physical through thought, right? To try to rationalize, because I'll get that feedback of something is wrong. And I have to tell my body, basically, nothing's wrong. You're okay. You're in the house. Everyone's fine. Your kids are alive. You know, the electricity's on. There's nothing. There's no tiger chasing you right now. But my body can be in a state of giving me that feedback of there's a tiger in the room.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have that where it's like, okay, you're saying like it starts, and maybe it is, maybe it did start in the mind and there's some more unraveling to happen. But I feel like in a sense that there's a physical thing that's happening to me consistently. And so I'm constantly having to use thought and rationale to kind of rebalance out my body.
Okay. And if it's working, keep doing it, right? Whatever works. However, I think, you know, these emotional problems don't get solved for most people because how they try to solve them is the source of it. It's thought.
Right. So is that like that portion of self-improvement, like when Christian brought up, like when someone comes to your center, like what are they seeking? And then you started with what's normally offered and available. So is mm-hmm. what Christian just mentioned, like kind of like the antiquated approach that is the antithesis of what you guys offer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what would be the counterpoint to sure. those? Like, I mean, to me, those sounded like grounding methods, bring mm-hmm. you back to reality, which can be very helpful in the moment.
Agree.
But what's the other?
Mm-hmm. So to kind of look at how change, lasting, sustainable change without effort unfolds is important. So I drove here. That takes time. I put on clothes. I changed. That takes time. So our experience tends to include time in order for change to take place. The body changes in time if you want to get in shape or whatever. So when we want to change psychologically, people say, I'm going to go talk to someone, right? And they talk and they talk and they talk. And they keep going and they keep going. So all of this is done
up on... And they keep paying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sell books, right? Programs. Yeah. So the variable of time on a clock included in the equation of change psychologically prevents it because it keeps time in the equation. I'm getting better, right? I'm getting nicer. I'm getting whatever.
I keep interjecting, but because I think from our conversation we had, you know, whatever it was, like a year ago or something, I think that was probably my key kind of takeaway was like, oh, I can just own. I don't have to like go through a process like I'm a longing. Like if I want to exist in a better state, I can just do that. Like I don't have to like. Certain like with that experience of like, oh, that's fear. I know what that is. I just need to start my day and take action and start moving rather than getting stuck in this, you know, analysis paralysis where I don't take any action. And I think before we had sat down and talked, you know, I thought, well, in order for me to have that level of awareness, I would have to go through some sort of process or whatever in order to get that, but not realizing that I can access it, you know. I guess the words I would use is like, I would use the words of there's a God consciousness that's consistently available to me uh-huh. that I can tap to, and there is no separation between me and this God consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And if I want to, I can just immediately return to God at any moment. And in the returning to God, it kind of, I know these are just words, but it kind of rights the ship.
For sure. Me.
It puts it into perspective. Mm-hmm. And then I think the result of that is I don't take myself as seriously anymore. So I'm laughing at myself. When I realized this was fear, I was literally like, looked probably like a crazy person in my bedroom laughing, you know, with no one around. Cause I'm like, oh my God, I like fell for it again. Like it was funny because I wasn't so attached to that experience. You know what I mean? So that's I think great. That was a very helpful with this whole thing of like, because that's your experience. Your experience was you had a very transformational, sustained change through meditation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's the consciousness that hears something about its own operation and moving forward, the form expresses that. So it's not you who changes. You do change in time, moving forward in the body and form from a new understanding of yourself, but it's not the responsibility of Reed to change. So this is a big, one of the first things that the beginning and the end is orienting someone in a way that the listening takes place without a listener. Because as long as the commentary arises inwardly, then consciousness is divided, attention is divided, because there's hearing with the ears, right? And then that inward movement of thought is slicing and dicing mm-hmm. and doing its thing.
Yeah.
And that very activity stirs consciousness, holds attention in a restricted way, and prevents consciousness from hearing more nakedly or...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So
it's kind of like going down a conveyor belt and going, sorting it, going, that's good, that's bad, that's helpful, that's not helpful. I agree, I don't agree.
Mm-hmm.
That hurts, that don't hurt.
Yep.
Yeah.
But isn't that, like, I've heard that associating those kinds of labels on things can be more beneficial than helpful. Like, because it takes away from things just being, you know, like, well, this is good, well, this is bad. Well, why? Who decided that was good and decided right. that was bad? Mm-hmm. Who decided that this is what feels good and this is what feels bad when things just are? That one was like the mind-blowing thing for me. I'm like, wait, hold on a minute. So is that like when you talk about like thoughts producing more thoughts, which are like a physical thing that happen in the brain,
mm-hmm.
but then you also are associating thoughts and time. Is it like comparing thoughts being physical only in the brain versus action being physical in the world? I'm
talking about thought creating inward time, the sense of me and my yesterdays. We imagine that we can think about our past,
mm-hmm.
right? And people are like, yeah, I'm thinking of my past. You can't, because it's not there to think about.
Huh?
It's not there to think about.
Wait, but... Right? So earlier,
mm-hmm.
you said that the thoughts were all from, I might be misparaphrasing. I'm trying to understand.
Good. Keep going.
When you said that thoughts are all from past experiences and then they remain limited,
mm-hmm.
but now we're saying we can't think about the past because it's not there.
Correct. So the representation of our yesterdays appears now through this power of thought in the human. So we can think about and talk about my phone because it's here and we can explore it, but my yesterdays aren't here.
So is that because it's just a memory and therefore it could be like your phone's there, that's undeniable, it's right there, you know, we could disagree about the size, we take out a tape measure, that's the size of it, there's no arguing that,
mm-hmm.
but your memories can be fallible. Is that
they are, right? Because they're all abstractions. all thought is abstractions. The fact that it's Friday is an abstraction.
Yes, because someone made that up at Sunday.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, they were like, this right. is Sunday because I said so. Mm-hmm. And then we just right. continued.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it helps, right, with order, but... Mm-hmm.
And I think that's like a little bit of what trauma therapy is doing, right? Like when, especially like the EMDR, where you're taking your memory of a traumatic event and then reframe it. Right, which I've heard neurologists talking about that, that's how you can physically rewire the sure. brain by you redefine your past. So you could, like, in you may have been looking at your past in a certain light and in a certain way, and by kind of opening that up, looking at it, and then assigning new meaning to these things, that it actually can physically change brain. Like neurological movement and how electrons move through the brain.
Yes.
Right.
So you nailed it. It's this meaning, the meaning, when the meaning changes, your being changes. So by reframing, you're forcefully, not forcefully, but you're altering the meaning of this past. So when it rises in consciousness, the expression in the body no longer carries that same charge. So what we're able to do is not investigate isolated incidents of our yesterdays, but really look at this whole thing of memory as it all memory. And when all memory means something different, then you don't have to. It's all memory.
Yeah.
It means all memory means something different. You just see it's all memory.
Yeah.
Regardless of what it was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's all kind of fugazi, you know. It's like a woozy, a wheezy, you know. It's like, it doesn't really exist, you know.
That's what I'm gathering from this, is nothing's real except for that phone right there.
Well, but this thinking in the brain is very real. And people are acting like, and people are making videos saying that thoughts are like clouds in the sky. But clouds in the sky don't leave a trace. Thoughts in the brain leave a material residue in the brain.
Well, because thoughts can lead to physical reactions in your body.
So maybe we just eliminate the distinction between thoughts in the body and say we can use different words, but to just kind of talk about one process. So the body is this is a display and expression of how thought is functioning.
Okay, so when you say this, are you meaning your body or is it specifically the body. Your gut? Okay.
The whole body.
Because I've heard other things about your gut being your real brain, and so I just want to make sure we're talking about the right brain.
That's right, yeah. I've heard that too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so and I think that's like a common, like we separate the mind from the body.
Yeah, and that's
we separate the mind from the brain a lot too. Like if you've mm-hmm. ever sat, like I have a friend who's a neuropsychologist, and sitting and having a lot of conversations with him and having him on the show, it really kind of like it's humbling in a way. It's helpful for me, very helpful to realize, oh, this is just shit that's going on in this organ here.
Right.
Like when he kind of breaks it down in those ways, and this is what your frontal lobe's doing, and you're this, and you're medulla oblongata, and it's like, oh, like this is a biological process, which really helps me to kind of lose some of that investment in it that I have. And I think that's kind of what you're getting, like when someone's coming with all this stuff, and you say in a general way, if we look at it all, it's kind of saying it's all kind of thought is all this thing. Once you start at the you, whatever the you is that's looking at thought, right, goes, oh, that's just the mechanism doing its thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the lasting change can occur, because you're kind of uprooting the whole process.
Right, right. You're seeing that thought has produced everything in here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's produced all these nations that people defend as if they're just there.
Right.
Yeah. It's all thought.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of the cool thing, right? It's like you, it all comes from an idea. Someone at some point, whatever's in existence in the material was at some point had to start in this place.
Right.
Thought.
Mm-hmm. Right? Other than nature.
Yeah. Other than nature.
Yeah.
What if kicking nature's it. Thinking?
God's thought.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Nature is
the
thinking.
Forest.
Think your houseplants judge you?
I think these two ferns here are just really happy being ferns.
Yeah. And I'm between two ferns.
And you're between two ferns.
Wait, so if we're talking about, you know, separating the mind and the body when they're really not separated.
Yeah, two views to one unfolding reality.
Yeah, well, a phrase that I know I hear a lot is the mind-body connection. And so would that really just be redundant, or is that possibly an effort to get people back to realizing that your mind is part of your body? Because I know, like for me, it's one thing, like, there's, you know, mind-body connection, but, like, when I go to the gym, right, I need to have that mind-muscle connection, so that way I'm consciously thinking of what muscle group am I trying to hit, so mm-hmm. I know if I have, like, proper form or whatever, am I wasting my time doing this if I'm not doing it right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a huge difference versus if I'm actively thinking about that versus not. So would that be, like, connecting the two things that already are connected, but mm-hmm, that's like mm-hmm. Not a forceful effort, but it's a conscious effort.
Yeah,
I have
intentional.
To make.
Yeah. So that would be, it's a biological word, proprioception. You ever heard of that word?
Sure have mm-hmm. not.
So.
Didn't Leonardo DiCaprio make a movie about that?
Animals have it, including us. We're animals.
Say the
right?
word again.
Proprioception.
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 Yeah. And it just, it's self-awareness of the body without having to bring in a self to be aware of it.
So without having to consciously think of.
You know whether you move your arm or whether someone else moves your arm.
Yeah.
So your intention to act and then the action when they line up and they're coherent, things are good.
Okay.
Like you got an impulse to act and you want to walk and you just get up and you can do that.
Yeah.
So if you're lifting in the gym, you're just being more sensitive to this. Your body is proprioceptive, just meaning it knows where it is in time and space without having a you to know it.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
I don't know about me.
And the mind may share a similar nature. The mind may share the same nature as the body.
Okay. But then that would explain or kind of tie back into we don't make thoughts. Thoughts just happen. So mm-hmm. I don't have to think about breathing. I just breathe.
That's right.
I don't have
you
to
don't
think about
breathe,
listening.
Right? Breathing just happens.
My ears just work.
That's right.
So it's the same thing with,
mm-hmm.
all right.
That's it.
I'm just calling my therapist.
It's just going on. Just going on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there is a parable. It's 8,000 years old, and it's about the inception of humanity on the earth, right? And so in this parable, these two individuals, these two humans, eat from this tree of knowledge of good and evil. And I've always thought, first off, this is a profoundly simple, accurate description of humanity, and they're trying to tell us something before they were writing shit down, right? That there's at some point the tree is labeled, the fruit of the tree is labeled knowledge of good and evil. So when you were talking about this, it brings me back to that, like, they knew 8,000 years ago that at some point we were instinctual animals, and then at some point this knowledge of good and evil, this thought, this self-perception, this awareness, this whole thing kicked into gear. And once that kicked into gear, things got a little more complicated. That's kind of what I think, like, when we think about that creation story, and a lot of people think of the creation story as like a literal, like someone was there, like documenting it, right? But when you look at it as this parable that's trying to give humans some reference point to why are things so jacked up, or why am I this way, or why are we all having a struggle here, and they're trying to explain this, because at some point we went from this union consciousness with the creator, like the trees are. Mm-hmm. The trees aren't struggling, right? And the mountains aren't like going, having existential crises, wondering like, why am I not a hill? I really like being a hill, and now I'm this freaking mountain, and so much weight and rocks and water, and oh, it's too much. You know, like, it's not doing that, right? It just is. Hmm. And so that there was a point, you know, that this parable is trying to get at that. And so to me, like, that's what I mean by returning to that God consciousness, that I can get back to this point of just being. Mm-hmm. Without all the morality and all the things that birthed from this parable, right? When I can get to a state of like acceptance and just being, to me, it's like there's a flow or rhythm that's happening that I unconsciously, I can just kind of tell, like you're saying, like with the body, I can tell when I'm in it, it's happening. And I'm not so judgmental or filtering everything or highly, like, you know, because I can tell when my brain is taking and sorting shit. And I've done it all my life. And to the point where it's, like, so exhausting. And it's, like, I don't even want to do that anymore. Like, that's just, like, a waste of energy, you know. So we started on fear. And you're saying the way that you begin to address fear is by first acknowledging this biological thought process is happening and reacting, because that's when you unravel that or open that up or become aware to that, then fear has less power.
So yeah, it means something else. Yeah, like if we see that thought is a reflex in the brain, then no one's responsible for what appears in it. So if a wild thought rises in consciousness, then it just rises in consciousness, and it ends all of the further energy that ordinarily is spent. Why did I think that? What's wrong with me? I need to have a better thought. I need all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's just no reason for it.
Yeah. Like, sometimes the worst question to ask is why.
Agree.
But why, though? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, my God, I don't want to know why. I just, mm-hmm. What is it doing to me? Might be more helpful for me. It's more helpful to go, well, what does that do to me right now? What does that mean right now? Mm-hmm. Does it mean I need to get up and go, right? Because, like, you can be having, have you ever been like having like a really tough emotional moment and then you got to go pee?
Yes, I am a woman in recovery with a bladder disorder. I'm very familiar.
So what do? You don't, in most cases, you get up and you go to the restroom. Like, that system takes over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We get it that the world's falling apart, but we got to go to the bathroom, and it's not that bad that we're going to piss ourselves.
Sure.
We're going to the bathroom.
So let's start there, right? Like, the body was trained to be potty trained.
Yeah.
It wasn't Reed who learned to be potty trained.
Yeah.
And it wasn't my mom sending me out in the yard by a tree that did it. Ultimately, it's an insight. It's connecting up that this particular sensation is a cue as to what's next. Just like the first time someone probably vomited, they didn't know that that was going to happen. And then they become sensitive to what, and then they say, oh, I'm nauseous. So all of these are reflexes, coughing, sneezing, and that insight that was the result of connecting up a bigger context of what's going on inside the body saves us from having accidents, you know, in the restroom. So what we're doing is thoughty training people. we're helping them extend their meaning of what thought is and how it operates,
yeah,
so that they can develop a sensitivity to,
yeah,
when it's off base.
Yeah.
Well, I like the vomit analogy, because it just like reminded me of, that sounded really gross, but it's because it reminded me of like an elementary school. Never in my life since then have I ever been around so many people who will just vomit out of nowhere. Like, my school like permanently smelled like sawdust because kids would just vomit in the hallway and never made it to the bathroom. Mm. I wasn't a vomiter, so I was just like, y'all gross, get away from me. But I've never been out in public with an adult who's not intoxicated, who's just vomiting helplessly. Mm-hmm. Because it's like learning what that sensation is, mm-hmm. you know, versus like, you know, with like anxiety, being aware of, okay, this is what my thoughts are doing, being aware of what's happening in there. And then like, oh, this requires action right now. And then whatever that action is, whether it be distraction, phone call, address it, you know, not just let it continue being because it's not serving me. It's not being helpful. And it's, you know, I don't know.
I agree.
Yeah.
You explain things a lot better than I do.
No, that's no, good.
I don't understand. My brain don't work good.
No, that's good.
Well, I mean, that's why I love having you here, because it's like we're getting to kind of like bounce it and then put it in our own language in a way that gives us handles, right? Which I imagine happens a lot for you when you're sitting with somebody, right?
Yeah.
Because you want them to grasp something.
I want the meaning to land in their consciousness, because then their words will just cover it.
The words are just,
The words are just,
Ram Dass starts one of his talks, and he sits in silence for a second. He breathes, and it's a long extended silence, and he goes, "We haven't quite reached the point that we can just sit here. So you need the words to help you get to where you already are." And he talks a lot about this, like, you know, I think I'm this thing, you know, and he calls it like being high. But when he says being high, he means like having a God consciousness, right? And he uses this example of, I'm walking down the street and I can be high on God, and then somebody walks by and I'm immediately a lustful, you know, man who wants to take that person and go, "Hey, I'm Ram Dass. Let me take you to my meditation room." And he's like, so the title of that talk is called Nowhere to Stand. And I've listened to that talk probably 20 times. And it took me probably 10 to 15 times to realize what he meant by nowhere to stand is that in each one of these kind of consciousnesses and these perceptions of who I am, I can never stand long in any one of those, in to his words, right? That, yes, he's this seeker after God and this lover of the truth. Yes, he's this person who wants to help, but he's also a human man who loves to make love. And he's also a selfish kind of whiny baby about certain things. And so in this talk about nowhere to stand is that when he accepts and when we can accept that we are all these things and we never really stand too long in any one of those, perceptions, is when we begin to kind of let go of any of them, because we know that we're never going to really stay there too long. Hmm. Which became very helpful for me, because with thought, it's like if you do something bad, whatever, right? Your moral compass tells you that was wrong. We can kind of like in our thoughts will just kind of keep us trapped in there, like hooked in there. And it's kind of like, well, that's gone. It's done already. But there's something, probably thought, right, that's connecting us to that and the judgment of that. And so we keep bringing that along with us. And here we are in a whole new moment, experiencing a whole new thing, but we're bringing in this thing that doesn't exist anymore, right? In some ways, we've gotten away with it or whatever, right? And rather than experience the moment for what it is, we keep pulling things from our past experiences. And so in this Nowhere to Stand, which is available on YouTube, he really breaks down this, like, not being too connected to any of these and realizing that we're going to dance around all these perceptions of ourselves. And that was really helpful. I want to use that as like a segue into the selfishness and self-centeredness, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of us are 12-step principled kind of people. That's the framework we were introduced. It's been super helpful to us. I know that's not your... doesn't it say on your website?
Approach.
Yeah, it's not your approach.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great compliment to it. It's not anti, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Which when we first talked everything out, I was like, oh yeah, this is like exactly it. But it's just in the 12 step, it kind of says the root of our problem is selfishness and self-centeredness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All of our problems manifest from that one thing, because we are so connected to ourselves and our own experience that we'll just create all kinds of problems for ourselves and others to preserve this thing. So what with that, when someone's coming to you with that, is it the same kind of thing, because of like breaking down the thinking of that there is no real self there?
It's a great loophole to be selfish. Like, self doesn't exist, actually. Yeah. Sarah's not here.
Hey, I'm not here. I'm just being me, so give me more. Hey, shit. I love how he really thinks about his answer.
He makes He's me going feel in bad there. About myself. What? I talk too fast. He thinks you think out your response. You're well thought out, whereas I'm just like, I thought about it. Let me say it.
Because he's over there thinking about thinking about thinking.
Oh my, Christian, if you he's say
like
thinking one more
in
time.
There, he, so he's like got to climb out of the whole thing to bring a response in this physical form. It's a whole thing.
We're being selfish.
Maybe there's, because I'm not saying it's good or bad, right? But I think that from childhood, parents, teachers, and society telling us things about ourselves, as that memory accumulates in the brain, it produces the sense of a psychological center that is the CEO, the entity that is somewhere behind the eyes that's doing all of this. But as long as that psychological center is operating, because it's an image, and the image gets hurt when information comes in that doesn't line up to the image within my consciousness as to how I want to be perceived or whatever.
So is image kind of synonymous with ego here? Or is the image the accumulation of memory?
It's the, but it is, maybe when we say ego, it sounds like a noun. So instead, kind of verbify it and consider this psychological knowledge in the brain operating as a movement, producing an image of me in time.
I think I'm here.
And there's, we live in a society that requires us to be a particular person, you know? So I don't think we can change that, but what we can do is be aware of how it appears in an unhealthy way in this organism. I think thought has hidden its operation in saying that things out there are good and bad, and that's a positive thought and negative thought. How many times do we hear that a day? I read all these memes and other treatment centers talking about this. And thought is...
Did you just put memes and treatment centers on the same plane?
Well, they put memes out, right? Well, I'm sure we do too.
I love that so much.
But for the physical organism, this body, the biology, thought can appear in an unhealthy way that's not beneficial for long term. If just like temperature, if I go outside and it's hot, my body responds to that, even if I'm like, don't sweat, it still does its thing. Same with cold, and you get goosebumps. And so to see that all of these categories thought has created and treats as if they're independent of its activity, and then just kind of scrap all that and go, all right, I got a form. There's an awareness of a form, and this form is providing this incredible intelligent feedback all of the time, and then getting that right. Suddenly there's an awareness of when we don't have to be conscious of breathing all the time or blinking all the time, all of these reflexes. We don't
actually
have
to torture when you become aware of it.
but we're helpless to not be aware of the inability to catch our breath, or if we swallow something, right, and it gets stuck. So, and we're swallowing all day and all night. Otherwise, never even notice the taste of our own saliva. So
I'm aware of my
It's the same with thought. It's just going on. There's no need for hypervigilance of, I'm going to be aware of my thoughts. That'd be a full-time job, and it's unnecessary in the way that we're built. You just use the body to wake up. Every time it rings, just see that when the body expresses all this muscular tension and higher blood pressure, that it's the hand of thought that's stirring the body. Because most of the time, people just look at this and go, well, what am I going to do about it? I got to do something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Take a pill or, you know, right, because they're not acknowledging that. I like what that illustration of the thought is stirring that. I was with an addictionologist, and she said, you know, you hold your breath, Christian. And as soon as she said it, it was like, oh, my God, I do. So because as she's asking me questions, and I would hold my breath, which is such a weird response, right? Because you need to breathe. Like, this is kind of like a that's like the state I was in when I went to see her. Like, I was, my anxiousness and worry and thought had consumed so much that it was literally stopping my life force of like taking a breath, and I would just sit and all she needed to do was say, you know, you hold your breath. And I didn't need any more psychoanalysis. I knew that's not good. Let's not do that. It was an immediate kind of, so this thought thing is stirring it up, right? Because we're talking about selfishness and self-centeredness, right? Being the root, right? And kind of maybe it's language and semantics or whatever, but you also said a couple things of like healthy, and everybody has kind of a version of what is like a felt need or desire of where they want to be, right? When somebody's coming to you and they're saying, here's my problem, here's where I want to go. Is it about helping them get to where they say they want to get to? Or is it kind of like by the end of the process, they've already kind of surpassed that?
Yeah, because like you said, right, if this God consciousness is eternal, ever present, then there's nowhere to get. So really it's just looking at what's preventing one from being aware of that now. And it's just this innocent misunderstanding about how thought works. It's very subtle. Most people will just dismiss it and go, oh, I got it. It's when the insight, when it clicks and you can't unsee it. And you're just like, oh. And then you deal with other people moving forward from that same understanding. Your whole paradigm has changed because you realize that your feelings don't come from the past, don't come from other people. If your past was different, you wouldn't feel different now. It has nothing to do with that. And in thought not meaning the same thing anymore, maybe what's beyond thought, which is attention, awareness, more thought still functions and still goes. It just doesn't do it at the expense of injuring this body all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So yeah. I get worked up, but it's more like if I watch Toy Story 4 and get sad, it has a sad ending, but I don't need therapy for it. Body's sad, but me is not sad.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Can I have me is not sad on
the
t-shirt?
Me is not sad. That would make a good shirt. Thich Nhat Hanh talks a lot about compassion. And I think Buddhists talk a little bit more about that. And that's not a word that's an English word, but it's not an American word, so to speak, you know, being compassionate. and kind of how you were describing that of like when one comes to that awareness and then you see these things in other people, judgment isn't the first thing. Blame isn't the first thing. Compassion is the first thing. It's a, oh, yeah, I know that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that is a powerful, and I think I've become more compassionate. It's happened to me. I've just noticed when I sit with people or when things happen. And certain relationships are harder to be compassionate in, like my romantic relationship is, because I probably have assigned a whole framework that I've built around that thing, mm-hmm. right? But even there, I've found myself in conflict finding compassion. And when I find compassion, it seems to open up and like it loosens that grip, the tension, the physical tension that I can feel. It loosens it up. And it's not like I couldn't tell you what the actual thought is, right?
Right.
It's more like of a sense of like, shit. It's usually like I'm the asshole, you know. I don't say that like disparagingly. It's just, you know, those are the words that my brain likes to use because it helps me to realize, oh yeah. What's interesting is for me is I inevitably fall back into the trap. And I used to judge myself very harshly for falling back into the trap, which would just keep me in the trap. And now when I fall into the trap, it's funny. It's, oh, there it went again. I fell for it again. What is frustrating sometimes though, is when the great thing about being in recovery is really good relationships, deep, meaningful relationships. And in some of these relationships is seeing people like running this loop over and over again. And it's hard to watch, you know, it's hard to see. And I guess the only thing I can do is like, I try to just reflect my own experience back, which is what I'm doing here right now. So I'm trying to say, here's how this stuff has played out for me. And I've used different words and different frameworks and different things. But I think in some ways I have tapped into that at times. Which is why I cut my sleeves off. All right.
How did you bring it back to your cutoff?
Yeah. I won't tell you what she told me I looked like earlier today with these cutoff sleeves. But as we wrap up, I'd like to, you know, any kind of parting thoughts, but also just really let people know about your center, where it exists. I know you guys offer a lot of virtual options. People listen to this and will connect to this from anywhere. And I think what you're doing is brilliant. I think it's beautiful. And I think people don't even know this is an option. And they are kind of running through these meat grinders of psychotherapy and analysis. And where it may have its place, it's also, you know,
there might be a different way of getting at it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So maybe a little bit about your center and then anything kind of parting thoughts as you would like.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we've been in business over 7 years in Roswell, and we do offer virtual, and we've done that since January of 2019, so a year before COVID. And the reason it works is because no one's inwardly shy. Everybody in here is talking to themselves. And what we're bringing attention to is the nature of how that is operating. So everyone's inwardly participating. You don't have to talk out loud in order to pick up on what we're doing. So the virtual works, and you can do that really affordably. And I think it's just helping people see that your physical body tends to move toward health on its own if you get a cut or something, and to help them see that psychologically there's a there's an immune system in play that is available to be understood in a way that changes things moving forward for the rest of your life, that doesn't require effort in the ordinary way of you being responsible for changing. So I think it gives people a chance to have a spiritual experience and collapse this duality between however we want to call it. There's a million ways, the perceiver and the perceived, the knower and the known, the thinker and the thought, because the thinker is just another thought. And the more we look into this, the quieter the brain gets. And suddenly, instead of just memory in the brain acting within itself on a loop, producing mechanical actions all the time, like an addiction, when the brain isn't doing that, awareness remains, the body remains, the brain functions, but it functions differently, and it's available for something more subtle, and it's this intelligence. So, change doesn't have to be hard when it comes to the psyche. It's just, it's a result of new information that allows for a different understanding as to who you are, because who you really, really are is this knowing awareness in which this life force is functioning with all of its perceiving apparatus. But there's just perceiving, and within this perceiving includes this function, this movement in the brain, and it gives it's doing us a huge favor by putting language in awareness so that it can be kind of seen. But I think a lot of times, like, somebody says something snarky, or you hear something or see something, all that chemistry fires off, and by the time there's an awareness of the chemistry firing off, that is gone. And then we're like, I'm mad because of X or whatever.
Right.
And so this really ends the relationship to the body's expression emotionally as being problems, and they're seen as just a paradox. It's not a problem. These are not problems. No more than when you're watching TV and a Chevy commercial comes on or a Ford commercial comes on. Those aren't problems. Those are just commercials. And you don't smash your TV, right? But we're smashing this. We're doing all kinds of things to this because it's just providing feedback that's been misunderstood. Yeah. And everyone could benefit from having some insight into this, not just people struggling with addiction, you know, because if you experience conflict or the sense that there's a dialogue and two different things, like an analyzer analyzing something other than itself, then this tightens that up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here.
It's good coming back.
Yeah, thanks for hanging out with us and blowing up our minds a little bit. I appreciate it. Thank you to all the donors and supporters who make all this physical shit possible. And thank you for Chad on the ones and twos. We think Leslie's working remotely, but that's why everyone's being called back into the office, because no one can prove that they're working. Thank you, Leslie, for doing quality control. This has been the Most High Show.
Good shit.